Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. You've seen our draft shows, hopefully, by now, live out there on Film Study YouTube channel, also on the Huddle It Up Film Study YouTube channel. Live coverage for roughly 14 hours over the weekend that I hope you'll take a chance. If you don't, you want to listen to them on podcast, they're certainly coming. But we're going to talk through each of the Ravens draft pick, some of the philosophical questions from this draft. And here to do it with that with me is Josh Reed. Josh, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Ken.
Josh, great to have you back. And we had you for the first night of the draft. And I understand you had your duties as a dad, not to mention your Anchorage sports writing to take care of after that. But you know, some interesting threads going through this draft. One is really the Ravens had kind of a mix of value in need in this draft. And we'll talk about a few of the clues that I think would tell you that it wasn't all value and it wasn't all need, but they got some of both, certainly. One of the interesting things that they talked about in advance of the draft was that they really wanted to trade down, and they never were able to do that in this draft.
Yeah, Eric Goss talked about how like they had some opportunities, but the math just didn't add up. Like as far as like, you know, the available players that they had, you know, available like or ranked on their value system, and if they would have moved back, it would have been too far, and they wouldn't have got the guy that they wanted. Like on day two, they talked about how like, you know, they had some a group of like eight or nine guys that they thought could have been able to get, and by the time they were on the clock at 86. All but one were wiped out. And one that was left on their board that with that draftable grade in the third round was Trenton Simpson. So that's why they ended up going with an off-ball linebacker.
Yeah, that, a little odd. And we'll definitely want to talk about that when we get to Simpson here later. But I thought what was interesting is the first two selections for the Ravens, the clock virtually ran out. So that should tell you something. Because last year, for example, Hamilton was still available at number 14. And they literally ran the card up. The pick was in like that. Well, I know they liked Zay Flowers. I know they love what he brings to the team, and there's lots of reasons to do that. We'll talk about that in a couple of minutes here. But if the value was so great, and the need is certainly there, but if the value was so great at that pick, they probably would have run the card up then as well. But they let the clock run all the way out, looking for a good offer on the thing. How do you feel about it in terms of they did the right thing after seeing the receivers go in that general area?
Yeah, I think ultimately they made the right decision as far as you know, taking a receiver, because usually when the runs start, you know, they go fast, and you know, like they said, this is the first time in I don't know how many years that receivers went 1, 2, 3, 4, and you know, in these successive picks and sequential picks in the first round. So from that standpoint, I think they made the right decision as far as, you know, take the receiver when they did, because, you know, as much as people want to tout the Odell Beckham signing and the Nelson Aguilar signing, they're both only on one-year contracts. So, you know, you don't want to be in this situation this time next year with no Odell Beckham. Like, say he has a really good year this fall and prices himself out of Baltimore because of the contract you just gave to your quarterback. So I think it was the right decision. I think they were afraid of that. Maybe if they would have traded back, because the reason they took it down to see if they were going to get a good enough offer without having to trade too far back to get the guy, so they wouldn't be stuck in another Trenton Simpson situation like they were the following night, where, like, you know, they had guys that were rated in a certain, you know, in a certain range and didn't want their board to get wiped out. So they took the highest receiver. They said Zay was the highest guy on highest receiver on their board. It was a consensus thing. So I understand, you know, kind of taking it down, see if you could get, you know, that squeeze the last little bit of juice, see if you could get somebody, you know, who's desperate enough to come up and not have to trade too far back. But in the end, I think they made the right decision.
Yeah, I think I don't know what they were offered, but if it's one of these things where they wanted to go back three or four picks, there weren't that many options on teams, you know, and then the general cost, I think two rounds back last year would be a fourth round pick roughly that they would have picked up from the value. And maybe somebody's willing to pay it and somebody else says, you know, we want a wide receiver too. And look, they all wanted wide receivers, or they all drafted wide receivers anyway. Mm-hmm. So it would kind of make sense that people had multiple receivers that were fairly close. Jordan Addison, to me, I would have taken probably ahead of Flowers. Although, you know, watching the film again now, since he was drafted, I've really warmed to the pick more. We'll get back to that in a minute. I don't want to spill the beans on this. But anyway, let's talk trade a little bit more. Once they failed to trade at 22, if you look at the total JJ value they had in the draft, and trades are still made on JJ value, even though a lot of people would tell you that scale is too peaked in the early rounds. It really should be flatter by round. And in particular in this draft, a lot of people thought it was really more of a flatter gradation of talent. But about 76% of their total JJ value was in that first round pick at number 22. So once they failed to trade that, they didn't really have anything more to trade down with. Their third round pick is a little bit of value, but it wasn't like that was going to create a lot of draft changing capital to pick up, you know, more third round picks, for example, you know, would have been very unlikely. So it's the kind of thing, if you don't trade number one, you really don't have much left, particularly in a draft where you don't have a second round pick.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Ken. I think that's the main reason why they took it down to the wire. They're like, look, this is our best chance to accumulate some, you know, relatively high or, you know, draft capital. Like what was it? I think the Steelers leapfrogged the Jets, and all they gave up was like a fifth round pick to do so. To get their left tackle of the future. If the Ravens could move back on a couple of spots, like say they like you know, they got like a four. They would love to have an extra fourth rounder or fifth rounder to move back from, say, 22 to like 25 or something like that. I think they wanted to move back, but not back too far. And the reason they took it down as low as they did is because they were like, all right, it's either now or never. You know, kind of sitting here at the pot kind of situation. And they didn't find enough. They didn't get an enticing enough offer. But I saw it was reported. It was like a record, like 43 trades. So for as low as people were saying that the consensus was on this draft class, the fact that people were making you know that many trades. I mean, there was a lot of trading back, and then the Texans traded back like 80 times. But you know, there were a lot of trade ups. You know, like I remember, I felt like every couple of minutes there was this pick was traded to so and so. They traded up for it. I mean, so even like the contending teams, the Chiefs traded up a couple times. Granted, you know, they were among the teams that came into it with a lot of picks. Same with the Niners. You know, like when you have a lot of like low round picks, teams tend to package those up and move up for players that they really want or think they might not be on the clock by the time they're on in the back of the round.
But you know, that's it's a strategy that could have worked to make them a trade partner for the Ravens, and yet we never saw that happen. And the Niners were brought up on the draft show several times as being an ideal trade partner. Mm-hmm. And there were other teams too that it could have made sense. When you get right down to it, if you're trading multiple picks for multiple picks, almost anyone is a reasonable trade partner. If you're going to trade 2 for 2 or 3 for 2, then you could definitely find good ways. Most teams want to trade. You know, when they trade down, they want to trade 1 for 2. That's the most likely. Sometimes it'll wind up that a 2 for 2 is required to get the change right in points that both sides are. Just the same amount of unhappy with the trade to make it work. Let's talk a little bit about 86, though. When the Ravens are on the clock there, they literally ran it down within the last 10 seconds before turning in that card. We were watching on NFL Network, rather, and the clock was under 10 seconds before the pick is in note came up. So they really were talking about it. And, of course, this is one of the other big questions of the day is that I think the Ravens were really trying to resolve the Patrick Queen situation before they drafted Trent Simpson, because they may have painted themselves into a little bit of a corner in terms of, you know, trading Queen at this point.
Yeah. Like Derek Cost was non-committal, not non-committal, but didn't want to talk about the situation. And it's a tricky situation, man. I mean, Patrick Queen, you know, I love the guy, but he seems like real mercurial as far as his personality, you know, off the field, and you know, especially when it comes to social media, you know. But it's a guy that I think the Ravens want to factor into their plans, but also know that, you know, the possibility, you know, the realistic possibility of being able to keep both him and Roquan, especially on the trajectory that, like, you know, that he's on right now in his career, especially that Zeke got paired with Roquan. I mean, if he keeps playing like the way he was playing second half of last season, this season, I mean, like he'll probably, you know, he'd probably be somewhat of a steal on his, not a steal, but a bargain on his fifth year option. But still, at the same time, like it'd be more of a luxury than a necessity. So, you know, it's a tricky situation. I'd like for them to keep that duo together as long as possible, but not at the cost of, you know, you're getting a position of a greater need and value.
Right. And they obviously, that fifth year option, the Ravens are going to be the ones who have to decide on it, apparently, now, unless a trade is made in the next few days, of course. But they have, I believe, until May 7th. So we're recording this on the early in the morning of May 1st. The Ravens only got 6 days to make this call. So they can trade him during that time, or any value that fifth year option will have will likely be lost. Now, the Ravens may pull the trigger on it. The Ravens may say, you know, it's not so much money that we don't think we can find him a new home, but you do run that risk that if Queen regresses and doesn't have a good year, then you got him because he ain't going anywhere. So I think it's more likely they'll allow him to play out his 4-year deal here. Hope for the best possible compensatory pick. Everybody's saying it'll definitely be a three. It will not definitely be a three. There's a good chance that it ends up being a four or a five. And, you know, Powers was a four, and Powers got a big deal. So, you know, $52 million. And I don't think Patrick Queen's going to get quite as much money. He could at the top end, but he also might not. And he'll really have to play at a consistently high level. Now, the good news is the Ravens appear to be in reasonable contention shape right now. I think they've still got holes they need to address pretty severely, cornerback, guard, some other places, defensive line even. But they do seem to have most of the pieces together at the important spots to contend this year. And having Patrick Queen at that second inside linebacker spot will be really good because, you know, ideally maybe Trenton Simpson, I wouldn't say he redshirts for a year, but maybe it'd be nicer to have him kind of wait to play.
Yeah, I definitely see, you know, we're going to get into Trenton Simpson a little later. But as far as Patrick Queen, I think the Ravens will end up holding on to him ultimately this year because, like, I don't want to say this is an all-in year for the Ravens, but it's kind of setting up for, like, all right, this is going to be, like, the best shot you guys are going to have to win a title for the foreseeable future. Like I said, you got Odell on a 1-year deal. You know, you got a lot of guys entering the final years of their contract with JK and Gus and even some other key role players that are like you know, a Duvernay, even Brent Urban's on the 1-year deal. He's the kind of guy that if he wants to come back, you know, he'll be back. But yeah, I just think, like, you know, they're kind of, I wouldn't say pushing all the chips into the table, but this is the kind of season where, like, you want to have your luxury items at a reasonable price for this year only kind of thing.
Yeah, it's it does look that way. I mean, you know, one of the things Harbaugh went out of his way to say, which almost seems pandering to Queen in a way, was talking about how excited Simpson was to get here and play special teams. Simpson's a third round draft pick. If they drafted him to play special teams, then they're already admitting the pick has failed to the same degree, basically, that Malik Harrison was. They didn't draft him for that. They drafted him to be a special inside linebacker. You know, they're hoping Micah Parsons, which that's about a, you know, rolling double sixes to get that, maybe better. In fact, maybe less likely than that. But they would really need to succeed to get a player like that. I think there's you know, there's more likelihood that he's a reset of the clock on a player who has some similar attributes to Queen, some similar deficiencies to Queen too, by the way, and hopefully will bring a lot of the same things on a cheaper contract, where instead of paying him, you know, $12 to $14 million a year or $10 to $14 million a year, let's say, you know, they're going to pay $1 million a year for 4 years roughly.
But going back to special teams, I know all Ravens fans kind of roll their eyes every time they hear, special teams value on this guy. And I think he talked about it, and then Caillou Bukele talked about, they're looking forward to playing on special teams. And, I mean, they definitely have the skill sets to translate to a guy who would be a good core special teamer, but you don't take a guy 86 overall to be a special teams ace. Even though he may be, I'm okay with Trenton Simpson being a special teams guy to start off, the season, to start off his career, if that means you don't hold on to another guy squarely for special teams. You know what I'm saying? If this is a roster crunch time, and you're deciding between keeping another corner and a special teams linebacker, keep that other corner, and bye bye Josh Ross or Christian Welch.
I think that's probably the more likely event. I mean, the Welch is the guy who makes less sense for the Ravens at this point in terms of where he is. But anyway, Josh Ross is a younger guy. You want to stay young on special teams. And my big thing about special teams in general is the Ravens, if they have the depth of roster necessary to contend, they probably want to have basically zero guys, maybe one, who are pure special teams players. And have basically everyone be someone who can contribute something on special teams, but also can give you something on either offense or defense. Because you really, I know Harbaugh with the special teams background probably values it, but I think he really values the players who can do both, not just the players who are pure special teams guys.
Yeah, like Justice Hill and Geno Stone, two guys that are capable. Two guys that are capable of contributing on both on the respective sides of the ball, but also thrive on special teams. I'd love to see Justice Hill get more run. I feel like last year was, I know we're not going to get, we're talking about rookies, but I feel like last year was just Justice Hill's, best year as far as the strides he made as a runner and the thing, he flashed a lot last year. I mean, I feel like it wasn't for that hamstring that he pulled, was it in the Buffalo game? I feel like he would have been in line to get even more run, prior to pulling that hammy.
It's surprising that he didn't get more. I thought he kind of fit perfectly with running the outside, stretching the horizontally the line of scrimmage out of sidecar, and making those opportunities for Lamar be extra special. But you got to have another threat who does that, and neither of the backs is really perfect for that. JK is really a one cut turn up field guy. He's not a real big speed guy. He's got okay speed, and Gus Edwards is more of a between the tackles and right off tackle guy. So if they had other choices, they could have put Devin Duvernay in the backfield, which they have done before. I really like the UDFA they picked up, by the way.
I was just about to say
that. I knew you were going to talk about him. Yeah, but he's perfect for it. So anyway, we'll get to that another day. I'm actually doing a show tomorrow on the UDFA, so we'll probably talk about him there. But he's a great thing. What I do want to work on to another quarterback. We basically touched on it briefly with cornerbacks, but wide receiver and cornerback, obviously were competing for the pick at 22. And they ended up at cornerback kind of chasing the price of cornerbacks as everybody else valued them higher, even a very deep cornerback draft. And, it was thought that the wide receiver draft was not as good as the corner draft. And certainly the corner draft had a ton of guys at the top who looked fantastic. They had a guy who I guess the teams know more about his injury than we do that fell a long way in the draft. That's Kelee Ringo. And then they have some fairly modest talent, I think, in the later rounds at corner. There's guys who have significant warts, as you would expect at any position later. And it seemed like cornerbacks were getting consistently overdrafted throughout the draft. Started off with Emmanuel Forbes at number 16. Gonzalez went a little bit later than
two picks later or the very next pick to the league one.
Did he went at 17, right? Forbes went at 16. So yeah, he actually went after Forbes. I loved Forbes, and he was the guy I really wanted for the Ravens at 22 over all others, over a wide receiver for certain. But anyway, I really love Forbes, and he was obviously not the guy who was taken. But it was, I thought, very appropriate that Witherspoon was the top cornerback taken because college results are much better than Gonzalez. And Forbes, honestly, are better than Gonzalez as well. So it's not surprising. It's just everybody fell in love with who Gonzalez was as a size and shape guy. and they ignored a lot of the college production, which was not as good for him. Even playing in the Pac-12, where, you know, it's not like every team has a great quarterback out there.
Yeah, and that was, to me, that was the classic case of media love versus actual football. You know, like if people there's conflicting opinions between the media and the outside versus what teams actually think in this year's draft. You know, a team I feel like media sometimes value traits more than teams do. Like, you know, so like you'll have a guy like a Forbes who was highly productive in college. Now teams are gonna value that kind of production and skills and instincts over just pure athletic traits almost every day, you know, nine times out of ten. So I wasn't surprised that, you know, like I was a little surprised that Forbes went before Gonzalez. I really thought 22 would have been a sweet spot for him, but I understand, you know, like I said, Washington probably saw the same thing that we all see with Forbes. You know, a guy is going to be a ball hawk and, you know, a shutdown corner, or like, you know, can at least take one side of the field away. But I said I wasn't too surprised by it. But I do think Gonzalez did land in a great spot, you know, in New England, and the guy like Bill Belichick is going to really, kind of show him the way.
Yeah, I agree. I think he'll be a good pro. I just didn't think he was as good. I certainly didn't think he was as good as Witherspoon. He was still the number two guy on my board of the corners. But Forbes was the guy I really thought we'd get. Anyway, enough of that. It's spilt milk. Devin Duvernay, the smaller issue that did not get resolved on draft day. Now, Devin Duvernay has a $4.3 million cap hit, and this really ties into the next topic as well. The Ravens have entered a new era. Would the Ravens of any time during the last 5 years have been eager to get rid of Devin Duvernay if they had him at $4.3 million? Well, no, because they had a quarterback on his first contract. But now, every dollar must be scrutinized to an additional degree because they have signed Lamar Jackson to his second contract. It's great. We're all happy to have Lamar here. You can't go anywhere without a great quarterback. We all agree on that. But, or at least most of us agree on that. There are some people out there who just said, let him walk. And they're, I can't even have a discussion with them, honestly. but anyway, if we assume for a moment that, you know, we're all happy with Lamar being here, or whether we are or not, the Ravens have entered a new era. They have to scrutinize every cap dollar very closely. Every decision is going to have to be very closely scrutinized. And, you know, there isn't a big credit card limit. In fact, the credit limit got greatly reduced by the Lamar contract in terms of what they could possibly do to go out and get a receiver, or get other players. So when the question comes up, it's going to be that much more annoying in future years when people want to, you know, just put it on the credit card, forget it, make it work, make it happen, Ravens. There's a wide receiver available. I want him, you know, and it does generally seem like it's an offensive skill position player that is always the guy that the Twitter flock wants to go for. It's never it doesn't ever really seem to be a cornerback or a defensive lineman. Those just aren't sexy positions, and nobody seems to want to really spend the money there, where the Ravens honestly have at those two positions in particular great need at this point.
Yeah, and the thing that perplexes me about that, when people like, and they always want to bring up the Josh Allen, Stephon Diggs thing, or the DeAndre Hopkins, Kyler Murray thing. Okay, yeah, it was great. You know, those receivers elevated the play of that quarterback, and that took their offense to a whole other level. But the glaring weakness what kept those teams from going to the Super Bowl or you know, making a championship run was their defense. So you're pumping all this money into these premium positions on offense, or really offensive skill position players, and you're coming up short in the playoffs because, you know, your offensive line, you know, wasn't up to snuff, or your defensive line wasn't up to snuff, and they were running the ball down your throat. You couldn't get a stop. You couldn't get off the field. You know, you couldn't stop their number one receiver or even their secondary receiver because you didn't invest enough at cornerback. You know, if the Chiefs have done the past couple of years to really kind of terraform their team into being the best one, the best possible kind of team that can succeed with an expensive quarterback has been nothing short of, you know, awe-inspiring. You know, they heavily invested in the offensive line. You know, they trusted their system as far as defense.
And they let Tyreek Hill go. That was the big zig instead of zag move by the Bills. They're also Orlando Brown. Is he signed elsewhere now?
Yeah, he's with the Bengals.
Okay. So, wow. Big change there too, that, you know, a guy they'd invested draft capital in, obviously a big contract, it was a, you know, a player they just couldn't hang on to.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And, I think that with the Chiefs, man, they made this strategic decision, like, hey, we're going to invest heavily in this position, this unit, that unit, you know, like they're playing, they're paying, what's the guy named Chris Jones, you know, hand over fist, because they prioritize interior pass rush over exterior, you know, over edge rush. And that's why they let go of Frank Clark, you know, like they're willing to pay Orlando Brown, you know, an average of $20 million a year or whatever they ended up paying. Who's that? Juwan Taylor. I think they're paying them like 21 or 20, $22 million a year. Like they're willing to invest that in order, because they know after what happened to Patrick Mahomes against the Bucks in that Super Bowl a few years ago, they're like, okay, we can have that happen again, because we're not gonna, this guy won't see the next decade of, you know, if he's getting beat up like this, you know, once we get this deep into the playoffs. So they opted to, you know, neglect certain areas, you know, the flashier areas, and invest in, you know, in the trenches, invest in the positions that's going to help them succeed and, you know, be sustain success and keep their most, you know, the most important asset on his feet and upright. So I believe in investing offensive lines. I believe investing in defense to be able to stop those, you know, high flying off at night, to initially stop, but limit.
Yeah. And they've honestly, a lot of what they're doing is trying to rotate through players at those positions. They understand the need to make heartbreaking decisions about some of the players their fans love. And Orlando Brown and Tyreek Hill were players the team loved, and that their fans loved. And they had to watch him go. And particularly in Hill's case, just, you know, a homegrown guy who'd had all the success there, and to lose him after all the success he'd had with Mahomes, had to be terrible for the fans. But for starters, what they got from Miami was way too good to pass up. I mean, just, it was an absurd offer that Miami gave them on the thing. And they were not afraid to break the traditional crap that goes with, you got to have these positions in order to win in the NFL. And I'm very much of the belief that while it is a passing league, I don't think you absolutely have to do it with a stable of veteran receivers. In fact, I think veteran receivers, you tend to have a very hard time winning against the cap.
Yeah, and I feel like what they did when they made the decision with Tyreek Hill is, I feel like with the same thing the Ravens might end up having to do a few years from now if Rashad Bateman ends up popping, prioritizing keeping Mark Andrews over a Rashad Bateman or over you know, even a Zay Flowers later down the road, you know, keeping that because it's the position of value. Would you rather keep your elite tight end at, you know, some like underneath $20 million a year, or have to pay an exorbitant amount of money for your receiver, you know, who doesn't see the ball as much, who's not on the field as much? So it's really about position of value, and the tight end market hasn't nearly caught up to the level of production and significance that they hold in a modern day offense that wide receiver has.
Yeah, I outstanding point, and I completely agree in terms of that. You're looking a long way down the road. They have Bateman for 3 years now, including what I assume will be a fifth-year option they'll set up for him. And that may not materialize. I mean, if he's hurt for the next couple of years, you know, that may not even materialize. Actually, it's only this year, because they have to make a decision after this year on his fifth-year option already. So, probably he's here for 3 years anyway, would be the way I'd look at it. And I think in his case, it's more likely because the Ravens are losing a couple guys after this year that in Aguilar and OBJ that would make a lot of sense. But anyway, let's get on to the players themselves, because I think that's what people want to hear from this show. Zay Flowers picked number one at the 22nd pick, 5'9", 182, 442, 40. Why don't you start us off in terms of your thoughts about the guy and what he brings to the Ravens offense?
I actually love Zay Flowers. I love Zay Flowers a lot. I'm on the same page as the Ravens. He was my number one receiver, not because I think he's, you know, like necessarily the best or the most polished, even though he's very underrated as a route runner. It's all the things that he brings to the table, all things he can do. I feel like he's the most multifaceted of the receivers, you know, that went in the first round. You know, he's a guy that can, you know, return kicks for you, return punts for you. He's a guy that you can, you know, use in a Devin Duvernay role. I wouldn't say he makes Devin Duvernay obsolete or a luxury, but like he makes him expendable. you know, because you can have a guy like Zay Flowers who's so electric in the open field that can do so many things, and you know, like I said, essentially serve that Devin Duvernay role. I just love all things he brings to the table. He's fast, he's elusive. Like I said, underrated route runner, real crafty, real shifty. Brings some of that Hollywood element as far as field stretching. And I think he's gonna be a great addition to this offense, and I can't wait to see, especially in this Todd Monken offense, man. Like that whole utilizing space and never blade of grass thing is music to my ears, Ken. Don't get me wrong, it was fun watching that 2019 offense and, you know, fighting in a phone booth kind of thing, but at a certain point, it kind of restricts what you can do on the offensive side of the ball. If the defense knows that you're not going to take advantage of every blade of grass, and they know they can fight you in this 20-yard box, you know, per se, then you're kind of fighting with one hand behind your back. Yeah, it shows people how tough you are, but at the end of the day, is it the best way to maximize your opportunities to put up points?
You're digging yourself a deep hole in this argument with me, I got to tell you, because that is – the fifth highest points per drive offense in the history of the National Football League. It is the most efficient offense probably in the history of the National Football League relative to cap.
I understand. I'm just saying like that was great for that year. And even 2020 was great. I'm not saying teams have caught up, but I'm saying it has to evolve. You know, like some of that, the more better operating offenses and, you know, in the years that, you know, that have passed are the ones that take advantage of space. And I just wanted to see, you know, Lamar in an offense that takes advantage of space and, you know, like, because to give him more opportunities, like I said, to, you know, to scramble instead of design runs and zone read all the time.
Okay. Well, I mean, we won't argue about this anymore. We're just going to go in circles if we do, but the 19 offense was very, very, very special. And it's hard to look at Jackson, the passer, in that year and not say, boy, he just didn't have a good set of opportunities. I mean, he had weapons in you know, primarily in Marquise Brown. They had space to work with that worked out for Mark Andrews and the other tight ends as well. And they had an incredible horizontal spread of the line of scrimmage that will be more, in my opinion, than what Monken will be able to accomplish horizontally exclusively. I think Monken will do much more for the Ravens vertically in terms of spreading the thing. But I think horizontally, what Roman did in terms of setting up that offense is really special, and special in the history of the National Football League, not just in terms of Ravens history in particular.
Yeah. I'm not recruiting any of that, Ken. I just feel like the natural maturation of this offense. And I feel like just to kind of make Lamar happy. And I know Lamar liked Greg and always, I don't say stood at the table for Greg, but defended Greg. But, you know, it just felt like things were kind of getting a little stale on that side of the ball, you know, for some of the players and, you know, even for the quarterback.
Let's get back to Zay Flowers here. So a few notes. Obviously, speed is near the top of the wide receiver class. The ability to turn on the dime, we've probably all seen the Twitter videos by now of him running that whip route, which is really impressive. Now, here's where I'm going to differ a little bit from you, because he's obviously a very sudden athlete. I don't think he's that great a route runner. I think it's actually an opportunity for improvement for Flowers over the next couple of years, working with a decent wide receiver coach, being a guy who can learn to throw off the defensive back before he makes his move, show wiggle at the top of the route, read leverage when there's an option on the route, but mostly throw off the defensive back at the top of the route so he loses half a step at that point. I think that suddenness is apparent. The throw in the move on the cornerback is not as apparent to me in terms of his ability to do that. I think he could take a step forward in that area, big area of improvement potentially. Adafi Owe is the analogy I would use, is that, you know, Jason is still a little bit down on his get off, and I don't deny that, but Adafi Owe is still a fantastic athlete. And if he makes a move to one side, that offensive tackle will overreact to his first move, and he should be able to use that to figure out how to counter. And I think this will be Adafi Owe's big breakout year in year three. The pressure rate has been good, and I think he can do more in terms of that pass rush plan, and we'll learn more from Chuck Smith this year to really put that into play. Obviously, both of the O's have to be good rush side linebackers for the Ravens for this to work out. But going back to Zay, much more effectiveness in zone versus man. And when you see a guy who's not as effective in man coverage, his numbers just aren't as good, then it's usually a case of wiggle at the top of the route is one of the problems. Some people also blame Flowers for not having great route running. All that probably is correctable at the NFL level. And in particular, the wiggle is not just a gift I believe you're born with. I believe it's a learned thing. So he's definitely got some natural change of direction, but I think there's more to.
Hey guys, I want to tell you about the Eufy Video Lock, because when I'm not podcasting, I am. My day job is a smart home specialist, and the Eufy Video Smart Lock is perfect. This is what you guys need to go get. It replaces the deadbolt on your door, so now you can come home without fumbling with keys. You can just type in a code, or even better, use your fingerprint to unlock. After 1 second, you put your finger there, pops out, my door's open. It's perfect. It also is an integrated video doorbell. We've all seen the video doorbells. We all know the ones that are out there. I've seen many of them get stolen. No one's going to steal this because it's your door lock. It's impossible for them to steal. There's no monthly fee. Other ones do. But this one, it'll record locally, so you never have to pay if you don't want to. The battery, it lasts up to 4 months. Plus, it notifies you ahead of time. And I mentioned earlier, 1 second fingerprint recognition. No, I meant 1 second till it opens. The AI self-learning chip will learn your fingerprint even faster, and then it opens up. Completely keyless entry. No more keys. And I know I set this up as I'm a smart home specialist, but anyone can install this. All you need is a Phillips screwdriver. That's it. And then you're done. Guys, I love this product. Make sure you check it out. Now, here's the easiest thing to do. Just go on to Google or whatever you prefer and search Eufy Video Lock. That's E-U-F-Y Video Lock. Or visit eufyofficial.com/video lock to see how you can gain complete control of your door, just like me, just like Ken.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Be done as a route runner there. I consider that a good thing. He's been a decent receiver at the catch point. Doesn't really have the ability to box out at his size, but he's feisty. And he goes for football. Nobody accused him of being an alligator arms player. Not a problem with the middle of the field. I love that about him. You know, one of the things we saw with Marquise Brown, and the comparisons are made, sloppily between Marquise Brown and Zay Flowers, is that Brown was a guy who had a ton of speed, could stretch the defense. And so Zay Flowers is just like that. Well, Zay Flowers likes to go over the middle of the field on deep crossers. He doesn't have the fear. He's not going to be and the injuries won't force him to be a guy who wants to go down rather than take a hit in the middle of the field. And Zay Flowers has been a great yak player in college, really proven that he's had the ability to do that. Gadget options. We're in existence with Brown, so there's some similarities there. He ran the ball, I think, 57 times in college for 6.1 yards per rush. So you can do a lot of things gadget-wise with him. I don't think they'll line him up in the backfield, but I think there will be the jet sweep options will be open. It won't just have to be Duvernay. If they're both on the field, it kind of gives you a jet sweep either way option. You get the pitch plays that are passes but are behind the line of scrimmage that we've seen with Brown are certainly an option in this offense. So lots of things in terms of gadget. Maybe give you a chance to react to some of the gadget components or other route running stuff.
Yeah, I could definitely see him, sending him like orbit motion or something like that, something in the backfield, like an extended handoff kind of thing, just to kind of get him into space and let him operate, especially to like the wide side of the field where he has more room to operate. But as far as the route running thing, I didn't mean to insinuate that he's an above average route runner, just that he's not as raw as some people like, you know, like claimed that he was. You know, I've seen plenty of videos, and even Travis Kelce went on NFL Live and attest to his his route running was kind of. When people say that he's beyond his years in a certain aspect of the game, that doesn't mean that, oh, he's already like on elite pro level, but he's just better than most guys coming into the league as far as, you know, beyond his years. So I definitely agree with that assessment of his route running ability. But yeah, every rookie is kind of starting, I wouldn't say starting ground zero, but comes in with plenty of, like, you want rookies that with plenty of more to improve on.
Yep.
You know, I mean, you don't want a guy that's going to take forever to develop. But at the same time, you want a guy that, okay, this is only the tip of the iceberg, and he's already really, really good.
Yeah, yep, exactly. Definitely areas of improvement are big. Even for a first-round player, you want that in terms of potential upside. So you, same way, you want a pass rusher who maybe hasn't completely developed his toolkit. That's in some ways better. In other ways, you want to get the value on the first contract. So, you know, I'm conflicted at times between those things. But in the case of Flowers, I think there's definitely plenty to like right now. He should be able to take the lid off the defense for this team, create lots of opportunities between level two and level three. And when you think about it, the Ravens don't have a lot of other vertical threats. Bateman is really the only other one. And, you know, coming off the foot injury, we'll see where Bateman is in terms of his ability to really stretch the field vertically. But one of the things that makes Bateman effective there isn't necessarily speed. It's the fact that he's very deceptive at the top of the route and can run anything. And so he still stays at the X, I would presume, for most snaps. And a guy like Zay Flowers would be at the Z, more than likely in the slot some, as a guy who could move around and run a bunch of different routes, but mostly take the top off the defense and create problems beyond level two, at least. Now, one thing he did in college was there's a very barbelled set of receptions. And I didn't transcribe this to my notes here, but I think he might've led the NCAA in deep balls, but he had a lot of deep balls in any case. He also had a lot of screen passes. And his ADOT overall is not particularly impressive, and his college catch rate is not particularly impressive. Now, playing at Boston College, had Jerkovic or whoever it was this last year throwing to him, who wasn't particularly good, and he hasn't had a lot of quarterback, has been pointed out by some of the pundits, but he's still got only 8.7 yards per target, and that is, I believe those are career numbers, 62.9% at 8.7 yards per target. So it's not what you want from a first round wide receiver, but he did not have good circumstances at Boston College. And when you see the plays he's actually making, I mean, they're exceptional. And you can imagine Lamar Jackson using him as an extended option better than his college QBs could, and really creating some magic.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a lot like that. Some of Zay's best highlights are catch and run plays where he catches something short and shallow and makes a bunch of people miss, and then takes off. And if anybody who watches college football knows that, like, the screen game is, like, I wouldn't say God in college football, but it's integrated in almost every offense. So a lot of times you'll see guys with low average depth of target sometimes, but that's a direct reflection that, you know, okay, typically you get your number one receiver on those little bubble smoke screens with some blockers in front, or just, you know, get him if he's like, you know, one-on-one and the cornerback's playing off. Okay, get on the ball real quick, let him make this guy miss, or, you know, stiff arm him to the ground and then take off from there. So I think that, you know, that was more reflection on that than an indictment on his ability, just, you know, to stretch the field a little bit.
It's definitely true of teams that don't run the ball particularly effectively. It's an extension of the run game in the college game, even more than in the pro game. And it shows up in the pro game as well now for a lot of teams. We see Cincinnati, for instance, using it an awful lot to the wide receivers in their offense. And frankly, I like it when I see it. I think it's a real weakness of the Bengals against the Ravens that they run so many of those screens, and the ball has to come out quickly to the outside because Burrow hasn't the last few years anyway, felt particularly confident standing around in the pocket.
Yeah, I know. I hate it, especially when they do it to Jamar Chase or T. Higgins. It's like an automatic 7 yards almost every time. I mean, those guys are just so damn big. If you give them a little bit of space off the line of scrimmage and they just, you know, catch those little screens, they're going to fall for like 5 to 7 yards, even if your guy is right there. And God forbid he missed a tackle, Jamar Chase is departing to the ground as big as he is. You know, you don't want to get posterized. So
one more thing I want to talk about with Zay and how he relates to the Ravens offense and how they run it in the future is that his usage at Boston College really underscores a general problem that the Ravens offense has had. And I think they now have got probably, you know, and some of this assumes health, the critical mass of receiving targets they need to spread the ball around more than they have in recent years. Now, obviously, the last few years, Mark Andrews has been getting all the targets. And when Hollywood was here, he was getting a big share of the targets, and not many were going anywhere else. And Zay, in his last 3 years at Boston College, his production has actually really in all four, 19 through 21, they went from 20.1% of pass plays they threw the ball to him to 23.4 to 23.8 to 24.5. Those are all enormous numbers, by the way, in terms of percentage of the pass plays that ended up resulted in a target to him. So that's very high, because a lot of plays don't end up getting targeted at all. You've got five eligible receivers to divide the ball to, obviously, when you think about it. So it wouldn't be that extraordinary maybe to have a guy get a fourth of the targets, but it is, because there's a lot of balls that are overthrown and not really considered targets for the receiver. So that's where some plays are lost. You also have pass snaps where he's on the field, but the quarterback gets sacked, or the quarterback runs. And those also are still in the denominator of his target percentage as a percentage of pass plays. So numbers like that are very, very high. And he's suffered by having more low quality marginal targets. So the worst 20% of targets that Zay Flowers are getting are pretty bad. And that happened with Mark Andrews too. And it's something the Ravens offense has the best opportunity to improve on. And Zay will bring this, is not having Andrews be the obvious bailout guy. So let's talk about what happens in that particular situation. If you have Mark Andrews as your definite bailout guy on any play, if you're looking for him first and all, then that means the safety ignores the outside receiver and then you let him play on an island. He comes up. It means that linebackers close windows on any kind of crossing route much more effectively. They're much jumpier on it. They get right on it. And you end up with multiple defenders in the area. Now, what can happen is any sort of a mistake at that point has a high probability of being an interception. So what are the kinds of mistakes we're talking about? Tip balls at the line of scrimmage, any kind of drop by the receiver himself. And Andrews is good, but he doesn't have perfect hands. No receiver does. Or tip balls by the receivers as well as overthrows. So oftentimes the ball will be high, Andrews will get his hand on it, and that'll actually give the safety an opportunity coming up to make a play on the ball, or the ball's just overthrown and the safety is moving up into the spot. You need to avoid these situations where the defense has a high degree of surety on where the ball is going to avoid multiple players enclosing your key receiver. So the only solution to it is not to have a single receiver you throw the ball to throw into more single man opportunities. It is basic football, but in terms of how top receivers like Andrews have suffered with their marginal targets, it's something that we need to find better ways to measure. And I think the Ravens offense, having the combination of all the tight ends, Zay, Bateman, and Odell Beckham, stand a better chance of getting those targets spread out more this year. And I hope that's what we really see. I hope we see a very well-spread set of targets.
Yeah, and what you just outlined was exactly why I feel like Lamar has struggled against teams like the Steelers, man. The Steelers and the Bengals at times too, where and even the Browns to a degree a couple times. I mean, Mark Andrews made that one crazy catch triple coverage, but like that's the kind of thing the defense was going to do if they know that that's your guy. I mean, it was a couple years ago when the Bengals were saying like, oh, we know he's like when they knew he's going to go to 15 or 89, and you know, like then that's like if they can cue in on your guys before the play even starts, especially in obvious passing situations. Like I said, you're already kind of behind the eight ball on that, and that's why, like I said, not only is this like the best group of pass catchers that Lamar Jackson has played with at any level. I mean, dating back to his college and probably even high school days. Like, you know, I don't know how many NFL players he played with in high school, but the fact that this is not only the best group of pass catchers and deepest that he's had, and you know, at any level, but also like the most, you know, like dynamic and versatile as far as being able to have so many guys that can do different things and make plays all over the field, I think is going to help elevate everybody on this offense.
Yeah. So, To me, an ideal year from Bateman is actually, I'm sorry, an ideal year from Flowers is probably actually going to be fewer targets, a lot of deep targets, enough of short targets to show that he has value as a receiver at that level. But I want to see lots of deep crosses. I want to see lots of deep balls. So defenses see it on film. They get used to wanting to cover it on film, and that opens up opportunities for a lot of other receivers who don't have the same kind of vertical explosiveness that Zay does.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think he's definitely going to lead the team in average depth of target and probably yards per catch too.
Yeah, well, there you go. That's a good way to measure it right there. Well, let's move on. We spent a lot of time on Zay. We spent a lot of time on other issues with the draft itself. Let's move on and go down to number 86, where the Ravens made, I think, one of their most controversial picks, certainly for the value. Trenton Simpson, inside linebacker out of Clemson. Talk about some of the things you saw on tape from him.
I saw a player kind of remind me a lot of Patrick Queen, you know, as far as, the same way they described Trenton Simpson, if you go back to the way they described Patrick Queen, it's almost like, you know, this guy shot at a cannon, this guy's a missile, this guy, you know, he flies around side to the sideline, this guy runs around with hair on fire. They use a lot of the same words and euphemisms to describe Trent Simpson as they regularly do Queen. Like I said, I do see a lot of similarities, you know, to who Patrick Queen was coming out of college to who Trent Simpson was, but Simpson even brought more versatility than Queen does. You know, he's a guy that I think he had what 12 or 13 sacks in college. He's a guy that, you know, that really kind of just continues that trend of adding more versatile defenders to this defense. You know, last year you had a guy in Kyle Hamilton that could line up just about everywhere. Now you got a guy in Trenton Simpson. You know, so what Kyle Hamilton was to the secondary is what they kind of what sounds like this what they envision Trenton Simpson being to the front seven, as far as a guy that can line up off ball, line up on the edge, or even I hope not in the slot unless it's against like a running back or a tight end. And I mean, even then, I'd much rather have a safety over that guy than Trenton Simpson. But you know, I digress. So I saw the positional versatility that in you know the flying around with you know guy with the hair, you know, his hair on fire, or like the whole missile mentality thing too. I did see. One of the things I did see that, you know, kind of reminded Patrick Queen that I didn't like was, you know, there are times he didn't wrap up and he just tried to hit a guy to the ground. You can do that in college, you know, like where a guy's kind of comfortable, but you're not going to do that in NFL. You're not going to do that or nearly as often. Maybe if you come across the guy like Hollywood Brown, who's, you know, who's like sub 200 pounds, but if you come against a guy you're not doing that to Nick Chubb. You're not doing that to Derrick Henry. You know, those guys with good contact balance, you know, like not only are they going to, not only are they going to stay on their feet, but they're going to keep on ticking. So I like to see him, you know, like wrap up more and not rely on the big hits. But as far as, you know, versatility standpoint, I do like a lot of things that he brings to the table and think that he's going to be an interesting piece for Mike McDonald's defense.
Yeah, play speed is very high. So, you know, you see 100-mile-per-hour mistakes, I'm sure, is what we're going to see as a rookie. Lots of that. You know, I think – he has shown up as a good coverage player in college so far, and it really shows up in his downhill play more than his coverage between level two and level three. So I don't think there'll be any questions about his ability to cover in man, that he can cover a tight end, that he can cover a wheel route, that he can cover, you know, a running back coming out of the screen. There will be recognition is important. He's going to need to get right on top of that. That's something Queen was kind of slow to include in his game. But he needs to make sure that other running backs don't have, you know, beating us in the screen game like Jonathan Taylor and players like that who that's a big part of what they do. The high missed tackle rate you mentioned, 13.3% in his career. Let's peg that a little bit of what that means. And his was at 11.7% in 2022. The NFL median for inside linebackers, and I used who played 50% plus of the snaps in 2022, and this is using the same basis, the PFF basis for missed tackles, is 10.1%. Now, there are big discrepancies in terms of missed tackles between systems. So what's important is don't tell me system A's missed tackle rate and compare it to the guys in system B. At least I used all PFF numbers for looking at missed tackle rate in this case. At the NFL level, Pro Football Reference has a missed tackle rate that is more generous to defenders. It awards less missed tackles. The PFF rate, you know, obviously if they think you missed the angle, it's a missed tackle. If you're on these ankles, it's a missed tackle. I think I like their method more. The thing I don't always like is that there's missed tackles and missed tackles because a lot of tackles retrack a player in the backfield and really ruin a play, but they end up being missed tackles, or they turn the quarterback around and they're a missed sack. But the still sack still happens. It just happens a second later. Somebody else gets cleanup credit for it. I don't really like some of that, but I've got nothing else to go on. And missed tackle rate is pretty good for inside linebackers in terms of judging who's, you know, doing a pretty good job of it. To give you an idea, the 10.1% was the median for NFL linebackers. Roquan Smith is better than that at 8.6%. Patrick Queen at 13.5% last year. And that, by the way, that was an improvement for Patrick to get to that point. So, you know, he's definitely on the uptick from that said. You know, as much as we talk about missed tackle rate with Simpson, no problem finding plays where he's slinging people down hard. You know, again, there is a desire to look for highlight tackles. I would like to see more driving through the center of mass with arms together. You know, I forklifting would be fine too, but you know, I would love to see more driving through the center of mass and backwards. He's big enough for that. You know, he's 6'2", 235. He's got a very prototypical inside linebacker size for the modern game. All the speed, you know, he could ask for in terms of that. He was number one on a lot of people's inside linebacker board. Not mine. I like Jack Campbell better, but he was number one on a lot of people's boards at inside linebacker. I want to talk about his pressure rate for a minute, but you want to talk about his tackling at all any more than what you did?
No, like I said, he's a very aggressive tackler. Like I said, I'll give him that. I just, you know, a lot of times, you know, guys get caught up in trying to deliver big hits and they'll try to, you know, like put their arms together, kind of like force a guy down. And so like, it's like and I know that they'll try their best to coach it out of him at the next level. I don't think it'll take him as long to get that coach out of him as it did with Queen, because Queen was still doing it as of last year. And a lot of times when we see people breaking off big runs against the Ravens defense and this screaming TV, just tackle him. And then you have to, you know, wait for Marlon Humphrey, and he's one of the better tacklers on the team. So I just think if Marlon Humphrey just takes a little tackling session with everybody, like, hey guys, this is how you form tackle, and this is how we get him down. And you know, like the young blood players especially would benefit from something like that.
Now, positional versatility is something I want to go back to, because it's something I think you can easily overdo. If you want to talk play-by-play responsibility, that's a little bit different. I think he's pretty much set at the Will linebacker spot. I don't think he's going to be, Joker. He'll be, he'll play like Adelis Thomas did at safety. He'll cover the slot receiver whenever the Ravens damn well feel like it. And, you know, if it's 12 personnel, he's definitely on the tight end kind of thing. I don't think it's anything like that where he's an obvious matchup player, play. I think he's really a Will linebacker. And I think the more you can simplify his responsibilities in year one, the better. Now, that doesn't mean you can't use him off the edge. You know, a lot of times inside linebacker will come up as the second edge, or they'll come up in the A-gap and threaten the blitz. That's fine. I think also Trenton Simpson is one of the players who does a really good job of picking his own gap from off ball. So bringing him as a green dog, bringing him, on a delayed basis, using him on a cross blitz with another player, any of those are potential excellent games you can play with Simpson to get him the good opportunities that are going to make him an effective pass rusher. Here's part of the issue I have with him as a player is that he moved inside. His pass rush opportunities did not markedly change between 2021 and 22, but his his pressure rate dropped into less than half of what it was. So it was 34.4% in 21. He's one of the most effective pass rushers in the country. And they, you know, they used him as such, but still it's very hard to get as high a quality. I think it was 31 out of 90. And the next year it was like 105 times he rushed the passer, 106 times, whatever it was, but it was close. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't two times as many pass rushers and his rate dropped because he wasn't as effective. It was a matter of, a notably reduced pressure rate. Maybe teams are more aware of him and they were kind of looking to pick him up because they'd seen him on tape. The running back knew that he had to pick him up play after play after play after play. But honestly, there's just a reduced effectiveness to what he was doing. It'll be interesting to see what the Ravens can do with that. The Ravens, obviously, a lot of desire to run overload blitzes and blitzes that rely on penetrating and exploiting and tank terminology at a single point along the offensive line. Anyway, breakthrough and exploitation, I guess, is the correct term for tanks. But they do a lot of games on the offensive line that could get Simpson space. I don't love him as a pure pass rusher as much as other people already have ascribed to him. There's a Simpson mania going on right now that is beyond what the player is. I would just say manage your expectations just a little bit on who Trenton Simpson is. You don't have to be John Harbaugh and say, hey, he's going to be a great special teams player for us. But you also, you know, don't be thinking he's going to be Kyle Hamilton for us as a rookie, because I don't, that could happen. If it does, we're going to be the happiest fans that ever were, but let's manage our expectations so that we get some positive surprise out of this year.
Yeah, for sure, man. I do think some of the Trenton Simpson hype is getting a little out of whack. You know, I've heard some JLK comparisons and, like you said, Adalius Thomas comparisons. But I think like the less thinking a rookie has to do early on, the more effective he is. And so, like, the more you kind of cut a guy loose and not give him too many responsibilities, you know, like, the better off he'll be, like, and the fewer mistakes that he'll make. And, like, even if he does, like you said, you know, like Martindale always said, you know, if you're going to make a mistake, make it 100 miles an hour. And that guy's fast enough to make it 110 miles an hour. So I definitely expect him to kind of cut him loose. Not in the sense that, you know, it's going to be, you know, lining up as you know, as stand up, you know, 2-point stance or anything like that. But I definitely think they might, like you were saying, stand, like, you know, blitz him off the edge, especially on delayed blitzes. Especially, I think he'd be really, really effective, because the cool thing about delayed blitzes is, you know, if you have a guy that with great acceleration and, you know, he's run like 4.43 or something like that. If you have a guy with like really, really good speed, that's the kind of guy that could shoot a gap real quick, or, you know, if something opens up real quick, you know, he can even, like, before, like the running back, sometimes running backs, depending on the running back that you have in pass protection, if a guy who's not as adept in pass protection, you know, he'll look for work, and, you know, you can catch him slipping, you know, and so you can get a quarterback when he's not looking, a running back when he's not looking. And so I definitely think he'd be a great delayed blitz guy. As far as the edge stuff, I mean, John Harbaugh said that, you know, they envision him as an off-ball linebacker to start that could play some on the edge. Doesn't mean he's going to be lining up as you're saying behind Tyus Bowser. It just means that they might bring him off the edge to rush the passer sometimes. So that's,
which they've done with every Will linebacker they've ever had. Bart Scott, Jamie Sharper, all of them. Adalius Thomas. Adalius Thomas, not really a weak side linebacker as much, but, you know, it's a whole bunch of guys they have done exactly that with. And to note that you're going to say that you would get some edge play as an inside linebacker is kind of redundant. It's part of the positional responsibilities, is occasionally you'll be rushing as that second edge on a spot. And occasionally you'll be rushing through the A gap as well. So, you know, I love it. I think that he could potentially be a very good player. I think he resets the clock at inside linebacker with a inexpensive player. And I'm very positive about that. I hope they get something for Patrick Queen. I hope they can use both this year if they're both on the team. I hope they can find a way to effectively use both. But I don't think the Ravens are changing to a 4-3 because they've got these guys. I don't think so.
Nope. I mean, I could see in like maybe like certain packages, like near the goal line, or for a certain team like the Browns are presenting you a lot of 12 or 23 personnel, something like with a lot of tight ends and a lot of running backs, then you could possibly bring him on the field. Like I said, near the goal line, or, you know, between that 10 and 20 yard line where it's, the field is condensed, and you want, yeah, you know, guys who can fly around and hit and get guys down to the ground faster. I could see that, but on a regular basis, I think it'd be two linebackers at most.
Yeah, 5.4 yards per target in his career, and almost all of that has been yak. So he's allowed 100. I'm sorry, let me get this right. 5.4 yards per target in 2022, with 175 of the 196 yards being yak. What that means is he's facing a lot of screen plays, and he's playing great downhill football to reduce those plays as much as they reasonably can be. What I really liked is his career yards per target is only 5.6. I know that PFF is pretty tough in terms of ascribing the target to the underneath defender when it's between level two and level three. So they're pretty strict on linebackers. They're very strict on getting the screen responsibility and giving that to the inside linebacker. It's almost like their rule in scoring it is, it's the inside linebacker's responsibility unless we can see any other way that it wasn't. And I think that's generally correct, by the way. I'm not saying they're doing it wrong or anything. But the fact that they do that tells me that there was probably some desire to stay away from him. And even though I don't really see great recognition for him or ability to read the quarterback between level two and three that would really restrict the passing game, I think that, there must be something there because the stats on him are so good as a yards per target player. And I can ascribe a fair amount of that to his downhill play and allow very few yards per target on those plays. But also, I think that he has not looked great so far in terms of really knowing what's going on. And that's an opportunity. It's an opportunity to learn. Michael Crawford always tells me whenever I bring this point up that that's one of the last things you can expect a linebacker to learn, that almost nobody really is particularly good at it coming out of school. There's one linebacker who's unbelievable at it coming out of this class. That's DeMarvian Overshown, who only went a few picks after Simpson, by the way.
There was a few linebackers that came off the board in that same area towards the bottom of the third round.
Let's see. One other thing I want to ask you about was Zach Orr. So you got two people here. Talk about maybe what Zach Orr and Roquan Smith, the two of them, who's the more important in terms of his development?
Man. I mean, that's a good question because they even said that he was Zach Orr's number one rated linebacker in this class, so Zach Orr clearly has a relationship with him and has been studying him at length. But there's nothing like a coach on the field, Ken. I mean, when you got a guy like Roquan who can not just help you in the film room, but also like next to you, as much as Zach Orr can do all the film study with you and all the drills after practice and during practice and all that kind of stuff. But if you have a guy lined up with you who's in the trenches with you, and if you maybe lined up wrong or you may be a little confused on a thing, the guy who can kind of grab you real quick, like, hey, go over there, or give you the little signal, whatever. I think a coach. Roquan Smith is the kind of guy who can be coached on and off the field. So I think having Roquan, with him on and off the field is going to be more integral to his development than Zach Orr. Although I feel like Zach Orr is going to be a huge bonus in his development as well. If anything, but even the combination of the two is going to expedite his development. He's more than Patrick Queen was. The whole Rob Ryan thing kind of was a one and done fail thing.
And then Orr came in and Queen had a much better year in year three.
Exactly.
Or if going back to his playing days, and it was always a complaint of mine because I'm always very set in my belief that your third best safety is always a better coverage player than your second best inside linebacker. Well, Dean Pease had kind of a fear of getting caught with his defensive pants down and getting beaten on a third down play where he couldn't get his personnel off and that he'd be stuck with a dime defense on first down. Honestly, if the other team wants to go no huddle and you win the high leverage play and then you lose the lower leverage play on first down, it becomes more difficult to make that exchange. You still can't exchange, by the way, even with a no huddle. Then I say you take your lumps and win the high leverage plays. Make the personnel changes to make the high leverage plays. But or during that entire stretch and from 2012 through 16, the first 5 years of the Dean Pease era, they played only 3% dime that entire era. And Zach Orr was the main player. They had Smith as well in that time. They had Mosley, of course, who was taking a lot of the snaps. But it's the will and keeping him on as opposed to bringing in a dime back. And a lot of that was Zach Orr. And so Zach Orr had a lot of those traits in terms of being a good enough coverage defender that you're happy to have him on the field on third down and you're not really concerned about getting a safety in there. So I hope if he could be as good a level two, level three player as Zach Orr was, and I think Orr learned a lot of that from Mosley, then I think the Ravens will really have something here. And this is going to be a tandem we like even more.
Yeah, and Mosley learned a lot from Darryl Smith that one year.
Yeah, absolutely true.
Yeah, that one year they were together. And I think with Zach Orr, the year before he had his congenital neck thing, wasn't he like second team All Pro or something like that. I believe it was. He was on some kind of list, but like people knew who Zach Orr was. He was an ascending player, and like I said, had a very well-rounded game. I mean, like that tandem that they had for that brief time they had between him and Mosley was as good as any they had in a long time. And I feel like having a guy like that who's now on the coaching side, has been on the coaching side for like a few years now, that player coach is great, but also a coach who's also a former player and performed at a high level is even better.
All right, Josh, outstanding talk here. We're going to continue on in part two and talk about the round 4 through 7 picks and maybe a few other items before we sign off for the night here. But tell folks where they can find your work online.
Yeah, you can find all the Raven stuff at Heavy on Ravens, right for the heavy.com's Ravens website. And my full-time job is work for Anchor Daily News up here in Anchorage, Alaska.
All right. Outstanding. Other folks out there, if you'd like to be on a film study short, lots of opportunity this offseason. All kinds of things to talk. You want to talk franchise building. You want to talk scheme, statistical methods. You want to talk about individual players. Tell you what, if you want to talk about that one play, so I'm still recording some of those. You know what that is about at this point, I'm sure. If you don't, send me a DM. If you'd like to be on to discuss two individual players, one offensive and one defense at significant depth for this year, I'd love to hear from you. You don't necessarily get to choose the players, but the idea is to get knowledgeable football fans out there who have an interest in talking about one player on each side of the ball and talking about what would be a good season and what would be a great season for them. I'd love to hear from you. DM me. I'll try and set you up with an individual show to do that. Gives a cross-sectionalization to any kind of positional group review shows we do. So you can talk about, you know, what the player might do within that within his particular group without you being the only one who gets to talk about that particular amount. Anyway, DMs are always open. Love to hear from you. We'll get back to you real soon if you have a topic for a show. Josh, thanks for coming on. We'll come back with you in part two.
Sounds good.
We'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink. which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.